Hello, I'm Sebastian. Welcome to Nine Nartrees Podcast. Today, I will summarize and review the book, An Empire of Wealth, The Epic History of American Economic Powers, a broad interpretive history by John Steele Gordon that follows the United States economy from the first English settlements to the early internet era. Rather than treating economic history as a separate record of prices, banks, and production, Gordon presents it as a central explanation for American power, political conflict, and international influence. His account emphasizes the interaction of abundant resources, property rights, immigration, entrepreneurship, technology, finance, and public policy. The book also advances a distinctly Hamiltonian interpretation. Durable national financial institutions, sound money, and commercial development are portrayed as essential to growth, while fragmented or weak financial arrangements are associated with instability. Major disruptions, including the Revolution, 19th century panics, the Civil War, the Great Depression, and World Wars, serve as tests of the system rather than interruptions outside the story. Written for general readers, the book aims to make long-run economic development legible through narrative history and institutional analysis. I will give you key takeaways from this book. Firstly, wealth creation rather than territorial rule defines the American empire. Gordon frames the United States as an unusual kind of empire, a country whose global reach arose less from direct rule over foreign peoples than from exceptional productive capacity. This framing directs attention away from military conquest as the sole measure of power and toward the ability to create goods, services, capital, technologies, and large consumer markets. In the book's interpretation, American influence became durable because economic growth supported military capacity, attracted foreign investment, spread commercial practices, and exported technologies and culture. The argument does not deny the importance of state power or war. Instead, it treats economic strength as the foundation that made those forms of power sustainable. A country with a vast and innovative economy can finance infrastructure, absorb shocks, develop new industries, and project influence without relying only on colonial administration. This perspective also changes how familiar historical events are read. Settlement, transportation, industrialization, banking reform, and technical invention become parts of one cumulative process rather than isolated subjects. Gordon therefore offers a corrective to accounts that place politics or diplomacy at the center while treating the economy as background. His central question is how a relatively small former colony developed the institutional and productive base to become the world's leading economic power. Secondly, property rights, land policy, and early commerce set a developmental pattern. The book begins with colonial economic life because early arrangements concerning land, labor, trade, and ownership shaped later American development. Gordon emphasizes that settlement did not automatically generate prosperity. Early colonies faced severe shortages, failed ventures, restrictive arrangements, and dependence on exports. Virginia's tobacco economy illustrates how a marketable crop, access to land, and incentives for private production could transform a struggling settlement into a commercial society. Such gains carried grave social costs, especially as labor systems developed around indenture and racial slavery. Economic expansion in this account is therefore not presented as frictionless or morally neutral. It depended on institutions that distributed opportunity and coercion unevenly. At the same time, the colonial experience fostered habits of enterprise, local exchange, and participation in Atlantic trade. English legal traditions and protections for private ownership supplied an institutional setting that Gordon sees as more favorable to commerce than many alternatives. The key mechanism is incentives people are more likely to improve land, take risks, and organize production when they can expect to retain meaningful returns. Yet the early economy also demonstrates that markets operate within legal and political choices. Land allocation, labor rules, and trade restrictions determined who could accumulate wealth and who bore the burdens of growth. Thirdly, Hamiltonian finance and the case for national economic institutions. A defining feature of Gordon's interpretation is his favorable view of Alexander Hamilton's financial program and of strong national institutions. He treats public credit, a stable currency, organized banking, and mechanisms for mobilizing capital as practical infrastructure for a growing republic. In this view, finance is not merely an elite concern or a speculative appendage to the real economy. It links savers to enterprises, helps governments borrow in emergencies, and allows commerce to operate across regions. Gordon contrasts this tradition with recurrent American suspicion of banks, concentrated financial power, and federal authority. The destruction of the Second Bank of the United States under Andrew Jackson is particularly important to the larger argument because the country then lacked a central bank for decades. Gordon associates the resulting decentralized financial order with instability and repeated panics. His treatment is interpretive rather than politically neutral. It gives greater weight to the costs of weak or poorly coordinated finance than to populist objections to banking power. The Great Depression reinforces this point. since failures in banking and monetary governance are presented as materially worsening and already severe collapse. Readers need not accept every element of this Hamiltonian emphasis to see its value. It clarifies a persistent American tension between local control and national coordination, and between distrust of finance and dependence on credit. Fourthly, innovation. Transport and industrial scale turn a continental economy into a global one. Gordon links American growth to successive improvements in the movement of goods, people, information, and capital. A large territory and rich resources were advantages, but they could not by themselves produce an integrated national economy. Canals, railroads, telegraphs, and later industrial systems reduced distance, expanded markets, and made large-scale organization more feasible. These changes altered more than output. They encouraged standardization, corporate management, mass distribution, and the development of national capital markets. The Industrial Revolution thus appears in the book as an institutional as well as technological transformation. Inventors and entrepreneurs required investors, transport links, skilled labor, reliable legal arrangements, and customers with purchasing power. Gordon also stresses that Americans frequently adapted and improved ideas developed elsewhere. This point complicates a simple mythology of wholly isolated invention, while preserving the importance of American capacity to commercialize technology at scale. The 20th century rise of electronics, computing, and the internet extends the same pattern. Technologies with military and scientific origins became engines of civilian economic change once they were incorporated into private industry and broad networks off use. The larger lesson is that innovation is cumulative breakthroughs matter most when a society has the finance, infrastructure, labor, and market institutions needed to diffuse them widely. Lastly, immigration, crisis, and policy conflict reveal the resilience and limits of growth. The book treats American economic development as neither inevitable nor uniformly successful. Wars, depressions, financial panics, and political errors repeatedly threaten growth. The post-revolution recession, the banking disruptions of the 19th century, and the Great Depression demonstrate that a dynamic economy can suffer deep institutional failure and human hardship. Gordon's narrative nonetheless emphasizes recovery through adaptation laws change, firms reorganize, capital is rebuilt, and new technologies or markets emerge. Immigration is a major element in this process because newcomers supplied labor, skills, entrepreneurial energy, international connections, and demand. This is not simply a demographic addition. In a rapidly expanding economy, population growth can help turn land, infrastructure, and investment into productive activity, while also increasing the scale of domestic markets. The theme is inseparable from conflict. Immigration has generated recurring nativist reactions, and growth has not eliminated disputes over debt, taxation, regulation, trade, or the division of economic gains. Gordon's long historical view places contemporary arguments in a much older pattern. That perspective can temper claims that present fiscal or political disputes are wholly unprecedented. It should not, however, be read as proof that every problem resolves itself. The history shows resilience, but it also shows that outcomes depend on institutions, policy decisions, and the capacity to correct damaging choices. In conclusion, An Empire of Wealth will be most useful to general readers who want an accessible, long-range account of how economic institutions and material development shaped the United States. It suits readers of American political history who want more context for recurring disputes over banking, public debt, trade, regulation, and immigration, as well as readers seeking a narrative introduction to economic history without a technical textbook format. Its practical benefit is historical perspective, present controversies over federal power, financial stability, and technological disruption become easier to assess when viewed as recurring problems with changing institutional forms. Its intellectual benefit lies in showing how technology, law, finance, labor, and politics operate together rather than in separate historical compartments. What distinguishes the book from more conventional surveys is its forceful organizing thesis. Gordon does not merely catalog growth. He argues that wealth creation was the principal source of American global power and that Hamiltonian financial arrangements were especially consequential to that outcome. That interpretive clarity makes the book engaging, though readers should recognize its perspective and supplement it with accounts that give greater emphasis to inequality, labor, slavery, reform movements, and the post-war economy. The book is strongest as a sweeping, readable synthesis of early finance, commercial expansion, industrialization, and the institutional foundations of national power. It stands out for treating economic history as a central national narrative, rather than a specialized sidebar to political events. If you would like to support John Steele Gordon, you can buy the book through the Amazon link I've provided in the podcast description. After reading the book, please let me know what you think and share your thoughts. See you around.